passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody. It is John Pollock and Phil Chertok, and welcome to the UFC 268 post-show following the rematch between Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington. Hello, Phil. Happy daylight savings time as we are speaking at almost 2 in the morning, which will revert back, so it's almost going to be 1 in the morning. We are gaining an hour, so worked out well, didn't it?
Yeah, it's like we're traveling back in time.
Exactly.
almost like we traveled back in time to the last big event in Madison Square Garden, or the last big fight between Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington.
It probably was the last time Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington will fight, don't you think?
Oh, I'm pretty sure. I mean, it's kind of as good as it was. Hard to justify any more rounds at this point.
So this was the UFC's big return to Madison Square Garden, a venue that earlier this week, Dana White had stated would be the fourth largest gate in the history of Madison Square Garden. Take that, New York Rangers, concerts, everything. Fourth largest gate ever in MSG history. And it was built around this rematch between Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington, as well as a rematch between Rose Namajunas and Zhengwei Li. But man, we also got, I think, the consensus fight of the year, Phil. Is that guaranteed after November the 6th of 2021?
I mean, fight of this year, last year, next year, many years to come. This is one of those fights that's just going to be remembered. You know, when you get a new fan, somebody comes up to you and say, hey, I've started to get into the UFC, you got to go watch this fight between Chandler and Gaethje.
This card was, I mean, the fights were so good that I can't even like throw out like a sarcastic response to you of alluding to a different fight than the one that we are talking about between Justin Gaethje and Michael Chandler. This was, to me, an all-time classic fight. I think regardless of this year, I would say this is like an all-timer that we saw. Like, this to me will replace Michael Chandler's place, where I think many people have just put his Eddie Alvarez fights on kind of the pedestal of his resume. I think this, just from the sheer reach that this card is going to have in comparison, and quite honestly, of the level of quality that this is going to go down as the greatest fight of Chandler's career. And Gaethje has an interesting discussion of greatest fight of his career, but this is going to be one of them that is discussed for sure.
Yeah, that Alvarez fight was something special, especially because it was the same night as Dan Henderson versus Shogun Hua, I believe.
Yes.
It was just like a night of ridiculous fights. But this one was, we're sort of riding high on it, but there's no doubt that it was incredible. And like right from the get-go, these guys were firing. There was so many dramatic moments. It could have been over so many times. I mean, why don't we just start there, John? Why don't you go through that one? Because
we can absolutely jump in there. Let's go. Let's go here, kind of in ascending order on the main card, because they had the unique placement of this fight kicking off the pay-per-view, because Trevor Whitman was going to be cornering J- Justin Gaethje, Rose Namajunas, and Kamaru Usman, which is incredible when you look at the results of those three fights that he went 3-0. So they gave him a bit of a buffer here with Chandler and Gaethje opening up the pay-per-view before the two championship fights. So the guy would have, I don't know, an hour to kind of relax and get ready for the next pair of back-to-back fights. He had to go out there and corner for 10 more rounds after this fight of the decade.
Yeah, I mean, he needed some time to come out of it. The crowd needed some time, the announcers, the Twitterverse. This fight had everybody buzzing from the get-go and after for very good reason.
So kind of the context for this lightweight fight is that both had recently, well, in their previous fights, had their opportunities at the lightweight championship. Chandler is coming off that loss to Charles Oliveira, while Justin Gaethje has not competed since last October when he was defeated by Khabib Nurmagomedov in what turned out to be Nurmagomedov's retirement fight. So it's been 13 months since we have seen Justin Gaethje compete. And I think everyone had high expectations for this one. And it was basically stated that this is as close to a guarantee of a great fight as you're going to get, save for some completely random injury that would prevent this fight from getting going. But that was hardly the case. They came out, and within minutes, you knew that this was going to be, at worst, Phil, we were going to get a one-round fight that was going to eclipse Nick Diaz and Paul Daly, because that's what I was thinking, because I did not anticipate this one was going to see a second round based on the shots that were landing in this first round. It was ungodly, the level of damage these two were inflicting on one another in these opening 5 minutes.
Yeah, particularly Chandler, the way he was throwing every shot as if this was the last one he's ever going to throw. And he was able to kind of maintain that throughout the fight, despite taking incredible damage. But then, you know, he started off really well, had looked like Gaethje was in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Gaethje came back. And I mean, I can't even imagine you would attempt to describe what happened in this round. I kind of threw my hands up at one point. I was like, I'm done making notes. And I can't even score it. I could not score this round. It was too chaotic. I was too into it. It was amazing.
Well, I thought Chandler was... He had a smart plan in the opening round, because you knew that Gaethje was going to come at him with leg kicks, and Chandler had shown an issue with those in the past. So he was getting out of the way, but Gaethje would start targeting the legs. And that's when Chandler, he's throwing those right hands, and he is rocking Gaethje with some of these, but he's absorbing these, and that can force you to move on to your next plan. And Chandler kind of settled in a little, going to his jab, but then still loading up on it on his right hands. And then Gaethje, he starts to load up, and he's landing these big shots, and he wobbles Chandler at one. Gaethje gets wobbled by Chandler in this exchange, and then it's Gaethje going back to the leg kicks. The crowd gave a standing ovation at the end of the round. It's an incredible round. And it was an incredible fight that was going to see a second, which if you had asked me 2 minutes into this fight, it's like there's no way either of these men are making it to a second round. But they would, and they would surprisingly go 15 here. The second round, certainly this was where Gaethje understood what his bread and butter was going to be in this fight. The leg kicks were very significant. Now, I'm curious from your vantage point, Phil, because the commentary of Joe Rogan and Daniel Cormier, they were very, very concerned about the damage to Michael Chandler's leg. And you could see it certainly had it was certainly affected by these leg kicks. But I did not think it was as crippling as Joe Rogan and Daniel Cormier made it out to be for Chandler.
It was at different points. It seemed to have different effect. Like he did change his stance at points. I do think maybe they were emphasizing it. Also, the fact that Chandler had that history when he was it Brent Primus that he was fighting?
Brent Primus at Madison Square Garden as well.
Oh, it was at MSG. Yeah, so similar thing that happened, and he had to. So maybe that was on their mind. I mean, of all the sort of commentary emphasis, that wasn't my main complaint tonight. But they were effective, and I do think it did impact the fight. So I think it was appropriate to note it. And he kept going at it.
They played a factor. I didn't think it was a case of like Chandler was fighting here on one leg. I think he was still able to post on this leg. He was firing off. And I think if takedowns were something that he was looking to initiate, I didn't think it canceled out his wrestling based on this damage. But this was certainly Gaethje's big round in the second, where he's throwing uppercuts, he's continuing with the leg kicks, and he just gets destroyed with these two uppercuts, and Chandler just has to hold on to the single leg to survive. Like, he is this close to being done, and he's just holding on, and eventually he is let up, and he is able to get to the end of the round. Now, the end of this round saw an eye poke to Gaethje, and the referee, Mike Beltran, he does put up his hands for a T. Unfortunately, like, it is not visible at all to these fighters. And if the referee is not stepping in, and Gaethje was almost like turning away, expecting to get like the timeout. He did not audibly receive it. So Chandler just rocked him with a shot. And that was more so on Mike Beltran, who I think had to be much more getting right in the middle of that to assess the situation. But I thought this was a 10-8 round for Gaethje. It was very close to ending. And then the third round, this is where you can see the damage that has been incurred on Chandler's leg. But he's going to the body, and there's a big slam by Chandler, loses him and gives up his back. And then Chandler's kind of just egging him on, and Gaethje cracks him clean. I did give the third to Gaethje as well. So overall here, I scored this 29-27 for Justin Gaethje, giving Chandler the first, a 10-8 for Gaethje in the second, and the third to Gaethje, 10-9. Unbelievable fight. If you missed this, this is mandatory. If you ever want to listen to us again, you have to watch this fight, or else you cannot be part of this club without seeing this fight.
I would agree. And despite my skepticism, you did a fantastic job of recapping that first round. But even with your incredible pros, they don't do this fight justice. You need to feast your own eyes on these two men in the octagon.
Yes, this will undoubtedly be fight of the year. I cannot potentially envision. What was it?
Did we have something last week that could have been fight of the year? It feels like every week there's something that's fight of the year.
There was nothing at this level on last week's card.
No, I mean, there's nothing on this level on any card, really. So
Gaethje got the decision with scores of 30-27 and then 29-28. And he guarantees, I'm going to fight the winner of Charles Oliveira and Dustin Poirier, who fight next month. He'll either fight Oliveira in Brazil or Poirier in Louisiana. He doesn't care. But this will be one angry individual if they call him up to say, yeah, Justin, we're going with Islam Makhachev.
Yeah, I'd say.
And you, Justin, are going to get Beneil Dariush.
I don't think that anybody in the UFC wants that decision right now. I'm pretty sure they're happy with the idea of Justin Gaethje taking on, obviously Poirier's, always got an option with Conor, and that's the wild card, unfortunately, but he's right there, man. He definitely deserves it.
Yeah, I think you have two great options in Gaethje and Makhachev, but to me, I would still like to see Makhachev have one fight.
I think he even needs more than one. I think, you know, 2022 is the year of Islam, well, of Makhachev, and he could have two headliners, and then you put him in a title fight at the end of the year, and you put Gaethje in there first, and who knows what happens in this fight. I mean, it's essentially happening at the end of this year, so you can say it's the start of next year. But Gaethje, I mean, and the crowd reaction to this guy, man, people love him, and rightfully so. So I think there's going to be just a lot of interest in whoever he fights, because he's such a rematch, star.
Like a rematch with Poirier is big, and Gaethje and Oliveira sounds incredible as well. So I don't think you can go wrong with Justin Gaethje. He would be my front runner for this next championship fight. For those that, well, he fought for the title, new champion, and I think that he's someone that he has done more than enough, I think, to after tonight's performance, to earn that title fight. Or Beneil Dariush could sneak in there, and maybe Dariush will be the one to get the championship fight.
Dariush is not going to get the title fight, but he deserves to be put in a big fight that could lead there. So the natural thing is Islam versus Dariush, and then they're next in line after Gaethje.
How about Michael Chandler?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, you know, I just mentioned like how much the fans like Gaethje. Like, Chandler's made such a big impact in such a short time in the UFC, and then this fight just, you know, launched that to another stratosphere. His Dan Hooker win was on the Conor card, so a big set of eyeballs have been on him many times. So I think you put him in a huge fight. You know, serious damage here. Take a long time off
for both of them. Seriously, I don't think sometimes we celebrate these fights, but at the same time, there is a significant toll that comes out of performances such as this. So it could be a while. And with Chandler, he's 35 years old, and that's sort of hitting your upper limit at lightweight.
Yeah, let me. I'm trying to just sort of scoop by the lightweight rankings here.
Below them is, well, Chandler was 5 coming into this, and below him, out of the contenders we just discussed, would be RDA, Tony Ferguson, Dan Hooker, Connor, Gregor Gillespie. That's kind of what you're getting into in the top 10 there. Chandler, kind of like you have your contenders of those top 4. But beneath Oliveira, and I would say Chandler is definitely out of that kind of championship picture now after 2 losses to 2 of the key guys that, you know, I think you're looking at someone below the top 5 now for Chandler. And Chandler probably finds himself, I don't know actually if he will drop in the rankings here. Like he very well could stay there. It's not as though he's losing to someone beneath him.
Yeah, I agree. And looking at who's below him, you've got Dos Anjos, who's been inactive, Tony Ferguson, who's lost plenty in a row, and Dan Hooker, who he beat. So I totally see
I would favor through. Chandler against all of those guys, Phil, and with Connor as well. Like I would lean Chandler right now against most of these lightweights.
Yeah, I mean, just sort of going down the list, sort of an interesting name would be Rafael Fiziev.
He was the one I was just looking at right now. It's a giant jump up for him. But they are clearly very high on him as someone with that potential on top, as are Armand Sarukian as well. I think both of those are lightweights to keep your eyes on in 2022.
Absolutely. Sarukian is still very, very young. I think the Fizzy fight is a little bit more exciting. I think Fizzy's a little bit faster track up the title picture. So I think that might be more likely. But if you ask me which is, I mean, I kind of Tony Ferguson is the one that makes sense, I think, because he's the biggest name. And I think he's like at the end of his deal. And so you want to, you know, hopefully, get a win off of him and look good. So, I'm not sure, but I think whatever it is, he'll be featured very prominently. It'll be a big time spot. You know, he'll probably be co-main event of a big card or on a big, pay-per-view card again.
He is a very established name after these 3 fights and the level of fight that he just put out here with Justin Gaethje. Like I see him being in a very strong position, even if you look at him kind of outside of the championship picture. I think it's similar to where we'll probably discuss Colby Covington, where he is kind of out of that championship picture, but is still going to be someone that is a featured member of their weight class.
I mean, he's in that great spot now where it's not that wins don't matter because he wants to be a champion, but he's sort of established himself as one of the most exciting fighters in the division. And that goes a long way. I mean, you look at people like Cowboy, the Diaz brothers, Jorge Masvidal, just the interest in seeing you compete and be in exciting fights can carry you actually a lot further sometimes than wins can in the UFC.
I've just gotten a second win because our clocks just reset. So I feel a lot more mentally alive at 1 a.m. than 2 a.m. So the two most unfortunate guys on this card were Shane Burgos and Billy Quarantillo, who had to follow one of the best fights, I'm going to say, I'm not even going to say fight of the decade, because what does that mean? That's like a fight of like this year, essentially. So yes. I would call that the fight of the last decade and this decade combined. It's certainly to me in that conversation. And that's what Shane Burgos and Billy Quarantillo had to follow. And these guys had a very good fight. As people were noting, this would probably be a fight of the night on plenty of fight night cards. But it took a while for the crowd to get into this one because they were still just buzzing off the fumes of the last fight that they had just watched. So Billy Quarantillo, he had a game plan of just coming out. And while Burgos is certainly the more seasoned striker, he is just the more refined striker. He was just going to get, he was going to overwhelm Burgos with so much volume that he would not allow him to be able to find his timing to get any kind of rhythm. And I thought that was his key to success in the first round. So I did give Quarantillo the first. But Burgos did put everything together as the fight continued. In the second round, Burgos increased his output by a significant margin. He was starting to land with leg kicks and elbows. And in the final minute, each are kind of just landing on one another. And Burgos nearly finishes Quarantillo, and it gets saved by the horn. Into the third we go, and Quarantillo is having issues with his foot, but he still manages a sweep. It's 33-8 in leg strikes at one point when the stats come up in the favor of Burgos. So that was a big difference maker. And they note that this is the most significant strikes in a UFC featherweight fight by the third round here. Quarantillo, he fought his ass off in this fight. He fought all the way until the buzzer. But this, I think the tide really did turn after the first round. And I had Shane Burgos ahead 29-28. But how did you think each performed?
I thought both performed in ways that were commendable. I actually gave Burgos all three rounds, even though the first one was close. And even the third one was pretty close. Quarantillo managed to stay in there despite being on one leg and being forced to switch stances. And he managed to, you know, keep it close, make it grindy. But Burgos was just very technical in very tight spots and was ultimately able to land more and more cleaner shots. And I think those ended up adding up. One thing he did really well is maybe like four or five times he landed an inside leg kick as Billy Quarantillo was stepping in, and it led to him tripping or falling. And it was an incredibly effective technique.
Separate from that as well is that there was a constant issue of fighters slipping on this, on this mat throughout the night. It just seemed to be a constant, and I don't know if it had to do with any of the material on the canvas. Like when you put all those logos and stuff on there, like that does sometimes create that issue, but it's not something like those logos are always there. So I don't know what the issue was tonight, but it was pretty pronounced by the time we got to the main event, and there was a slip by Colby and they were noting it. And you're starting to remember all the slips on this card. It was very bizarre.
Yeah, I've heard actually fighters mention before, like different, the octagon will have different materials slightly depending on where they're located. I guess, you know, they get it sourced and printed nearby. And so that could have an effect. So maybe that was a cause for all the slips.
This was Burgos's first victory in about 2 years because he was coming off of losses to Josh Emmett and Edson Barbosa, who knocked him out back in May. And he was very, very happy about this. He swore a storm with Joe Rogan here in the octagon afterward as he was basking in his victory. Marlon Chito Vera versus Frankie Edgar. Frankie Edgar recently turning 40 years old and coming off the most violent knockout of the year, in my estimation, at the hands, or I should say at the knee of Corey Sandhagen back in February. So Frankie Edgar showed up here, and I think everyone saw that if this was Frankie Edgar finding a way to win, it was going to have to be a very wrestling intensive fight. And in the opening round, he was able to get the takedown and fend off a guillotine attempt by Vera. But it was Edgar escaping and then getting on top and controlled Vera for the duration of the round. So he took round one. In the second, Edgar gets another takedown almost right away, but Vera tries with the up kick. He scrambles, gets back up, and he drilled Edgar with a flying knee, and Edgar was briefly stunned. There was another knee in the final seconds. At the end, I think it was at the end of the second round, was it, where the two are trading words, and then Vera gives him the middle finger. And this is very uncharacteristic in a Frankie Edgar fight, but some heated words here exchanged. And then in the third round, Vera's just, I think he had his confidence now at this point that I don't think he was concerned about the wrestling, and he really let his hands go here. There's a left hand that connects, and he throws a kick as Edgar got a quick takedown, but he's right back up. And then it is the front kick from hell that just comes right up the middle and drills Frankie in the chin, and down goes Frankie, and this fight is over at 350 of round number three. Marlon Vera, your winner. And for Frankie Edgar, another tough loss, another stoppage loss for him. I think that is three in his last four that have been stoppage losses. Certainly a lot of questions for Frankie Edgar coming out of this fight. Although, if you paid attention to the video package, he was coming into this fight. Dude, Frankie Edgar, God bless him, he's talking title fights at bantamweight. So you cannot say that his mind is on retirement, and I am not going to hold my breath that this is going to be it for Frankie Edgar.
No, I wouldn't expect it to be the end. And hey, look, he's fighting extremely high level competition, and he was, you know, he did win the first round. I gave it to him. But this was the first time that I do feel like I found that he looked his age, because even though he didn't get tired, he did slow down. And that was what allowed Vera to land the big shots and getting close. You know, and typically Frankie would be able to keep up the pace for five rounds and even accelerate towards the end of the fight. But that didn't happen here. And the wrestling wasn't even as strong. Even when he was on top, he was eating a lot of shots on some elbows and up kicks. So yeah, pretty tough and a brutal knockout. Again, tough to see all those knockouts in a row. So if he is going to fight again, which we both suspect he will, step down in competition, take a big break. Yeah, it's sad to see greats kind of end up like that. And, you know, 40 years old, he probably doesn't have a lot more, left in the UFC.
Yeah, it's just a lot of factors against Frankie Edgar. It had always been discussed of just how undersized he was, yet excelled at lightweight. And then it was the move down to featherweight and the move down to bantamweight. Unfortunately, there's just that kind of trajectory of your age is going up, your weight class is going down, and these are high speed divisions. And for Frankie Edgar at the age of 40, like they talked about it in the fight, like this is not a division where it's designed for 40-year-olds. Frankie was number 8 coming into this fight in the bantamweight rankings. Marlon Vera was number 13. So you have to imagine Frankie Edgar is going to fall down some slots. And I guess you're just looking at, if you're Frankie Edgar, like you are not going to be competing for a championship in this division that houses Piotr Jan. Or, I mean, any of those upper echelon guys. Would Frankie Edgar work with a Dominic Cruz? You can find fights for him. The question just becomes, if you are Frankie Edgar, what are you fighting for at this point beyond just a paycheck? And that it's, you know, probably your identity as a fighter. But those are the difficult questions, I think, that a Frankie Edgar has to ask coming out of this fight.
Yeah, I mean, in a name like Dominic Cruz, in my mind, that's sort of the perfect type of opponent. You know, people, guys who are, you know, sort of on the tail end of their careers, legends, if you will, people who we haven't seen him get the chance to square up against with, not people who are, you know, making their title runs. So that's what I'd like to see. Is that what we're going to see? I don't know. I'm sure he believes he can still be a champion.
Cruz is fighting next month too, on that pay-per-view. So, I mean, yes, the timing, right. It would work. But again, that's really going to come down to people will, they will enjoy that fight for what it was or what it is. Two guys, former champions meeting. But to me, it's a really clear understanding of, you know, where Frankie Edgar stands right now at bantamweight.
Yeah.
Rose Namajunas, Zhang Weili. This was a significantly longer fight than the first one from this past April, going a minute 18. In that time, Zhang Weili has hooked up with Henry Cejudo and his whole team, so adding that wrinkle to her game. And in this fight, I thought that Zhang Weili had a pretty strong game plan here. Rose Namajunas is someone who, especially early, has looked fantastic. And this was one where I thought it was Zhang Weili who was able to really assess the timing of Rose early on. And when they went to the ground, it was Weili getting on top. And into the second they went, and Zhang was continuing with leg kicks. And there was this left hand that rocks Rose, who gets wobbled. And Zhang gets a takedown. Rose then gets her own in the final 30 seconds. And it was more so like in the early portion, I thought it was Zhang Weili kind of controlling the tempo of this fight. Rose drops her momentarily in the third round, and then they were clinching. Zhang then got executed a takedown and gets the back and ends the round in the mount. Very strong end for Zhang. And then in the fourth and fifth, I thought this was where Rose Namajunas was able to turn things around for herself. Each are connecting with right hands at the start of the fourth. And then Zhang gets the back on the ground with both hooks in, but Rose reverses, gets on top. She moves to half guard and was able to control her for the rest of the round. And the fifth round was similar in the sense that Namajunas scored the takedown. She did not have a huge wrestling arsenal in this fight, but she was 2 for 2 on her takedowns. And this saw Namajunas just stay in her guard. And I thought she did enough to win this. I saw enough kind of chatter online about the amount of work that Zhang was doing off of her back that I'd be curious to kind of rewatch this round. But I did score it for Namajunas. But I had it 3-2 for Zhang Weili. I thought it was a very close fight. And it seemed that the majority scored this for Namajunas. Did you see this for Rose or for the challenger?
I scored it for Rose, but I could definitely see it for Weili. It was really the first and the second rounds were kind of the ones that were, I thought, were the close ones to score, because I agreed that Weili did control well in the first round, but I found that Rose was the one who actually landed the better combos, and she was able to do more off of her back. There wasn't really any damage that Weili did in that round. And then in the second round, which I gave to Weili, you know, she started.
That was the one where she rocked Rose, and that was
it. So even though Rose kind of won the round, there was the rock. So, and then the third round, I thought Rose won most of that round, but then Weili ended so strong. Yeah. So those first three rounds, I actually, they're very, very tight. And then four and five were the ones that were ultra clear. So I know some people were saying that the 49-46 was crazy, but if you look at it round by round, you could see somebody maybe, you know, edging them here or there, and it just adds up to four. But I don't think it would be incorrect in any way if somebody had given this to Zhang Weili.
Yeah, the scores were read 48-47, 48-47 in both directions. It was a split decision. And then, yeah, the score that I think got the most, scrutiny was the 49-46 for Rose Namajunas, which, I mean, if you want to dissect these rounds, I have a real hard time on, I would say 2 and 3. It's like, I think you really have to work to make both of those Rose rounds. The first, I can see that one. And then if you're adding 4 and 5, I could go 48-47. To me, it was like the 49-46. It was kind of tough for me on 2 and 3. Like, I understand that Nama Yunus certainly had maybe more time in control of those rounds, but this is based on effective striking, effective grappling, and I thought in both, like, Zhang Weili made those her rounds on top of it. But, like, was this close enough? And we're talking about a strawweight division that, I mean, they were even discussing it in commentary. It's not the longest line of challengers. I would say you're looking at, like, Carla Esparza as a potential rematch, who beat Rose Namajunas all those years ago on Tough, and then Marina Rodriguez. Outside of that, like, the idea of Zhang Weili, I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that this fight will could happen again. And within 2 years, it could happen.
I totally agree. I mean, how many wins do you think Weili needs to get? One? None? Like, they just had, I mean, the one thing that's going against it is it wasn't the most exciting fight out there. And I think that the crowd was a little bit forgiving of that because of the excitement they had seen throughout the rest of the night. I think on a normal card, the crowd would be much more nasty towards these fighters. So I think that just the fact that it was kind of a lackluster fight might be the only thing that prevents us getting a rematch super soon. But yeah, it's not a deep division. Zhang Weili is extremely popular. Rose is extremely popular. And this was a very close fight. It was very tight.
It was close, yeah.
So again, so
I had it like 48-47 for Zhang Weili, but like certainly it's, you know, Rose winning is not some kind of a crazy score in the least. So it's a division that I think the idea of circling back is not too far out of the realm of possibility. But looking at the options, does Carla Esparza stand out? Like, she does hold a win over Marina Rodriguez. And you do have an interesting story here of Esparza beating Rose to become the first strawweight champion back in, what was it, 2014?
Yeah, I look, she deserves it. She's put in the work, whether that's what the UFC goes with. I mean, the nice thing was Rose said, you know, she didn't seem to have any injuries and she wants to get back in there. So, you know, not every title fight needs to be the most exciting, incredible contest that you can put on. So I'm okay with it. The storyline of the previous fight, I don't know how much that plays into it because it's so long ago. They're so different now. Rose is so much better. But, you know, you put it on another card with another big main event. You know, Rose is pretty popular. I think it'll draw a fair amount of interest.
You have no interest in Carla Esparza. Just put your cards on the table on this one.
I wouldn't say I have no interest. It's like I don't have any more interest in Carla Esparza challenging for the title than, you know, some of these other women, other than the fact that I do respect the meritocracy to some degree and she deserves it. But are you asking me if you put that on as a main event, am I going to make sure I'm in front of my TV to see it?
Yes. Let's move on to the main event, the rematch. Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington, the last time they met, it was December of 2019. If that year had not produced the aforementioned Zhang Weili and Joanna Jędrzejczyk fight, that might have been some people's fight of the year. I did go back and rewatch it this week, and it's a really great fight. It is not even in the stratosphere of, like, Chandler Gaethje, and rewatching it, like, and not even making it that comparison, but I watch it, it's like, it's a good fight, but it's like, I don't know if I would look back and if this had won fight of the year, I'd be like, okay, it was a good fight. It was even a great fight, but was it like an all-timer? I'm not going to go that far.
Okay. Well, I mean, you shouldn't be comparing it to Gaethje Chandler because you need to, you know, step away, cool down from that before you.
That fight 2 years from now,
you'll
bring up and it'll be like, everyone's like, oh, that fight was incredible. And with Usman Covington, you go back and rewatch it. It was like, it was great on the night. It was a really good fight. I don't want to like downplay it.
Yes, it is.
To me, 2 years later, it's like, okay, it was a good fight. It helped that it was close. I think that
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. Yes.
Just the action on top of it.
And look, there was a lot of heat on that fight. There was way more heat than there was on this fight. And so all those emotions had a big, big part in why that was, you know, and the finish, all of it. So,
well, this fight went through several twists and turns. We can break this up because the first two rounds, this felt like in the nearly 2 years since they last fought that Usman has just lapped this guy in terms of evolution, because this, what was so key to Covington's strategy in the first fight was his conditioning, which is incredible, and his just relentlessness. He was in Usman's face that whole 25 minutes, just piling it on, and Usman responding in kind. In the first two rounds, this was Usman dictating everything. Covington was hardly giving him a whole lot to deal with, and it just seemed like Covington was just significantly more reserved. Although what we did see in the very beginning of the fight was Colby instantly shooting for the takedown and Usman even getting a brief takedown, which was more takedown attempts than we saw at all in the previous fight. So interesting to see that aspect of things. The second round was highlighted by Usman dropping Colby twice. And had he had some more time, he might have been able to put Covington away. I did think this was a 10-8 round that they discussed later in the fight. And after two rounds, I was thinking like, wow, this is a significant gap. But Covington, whatever it was in that second round, he seemed to come out in the third and he was taking a lot more risk. And that proved to be beneficial to him. He was starting to just throw his hands and he was landing a fair amount on Usman. He continued to go for this takedown. It almost seemed like he just wants to, at the very least, he wants to walk away, maybe not with the championship, but take away that 100% takedown defense of Kamaru Usman. And it got into a big debate about whether he got a takedown or not, with Daniel Cormier ruling it a takedown. But the production truck told Daniel Cormier, wasn't a takedown, Olympian.
Well, I mean, it's a takedown in wrestling is not the same as a takedown in MMA. They're different sports. There's different rules.
I didn't disagree with the truck, by the way, but
yeah,
I'm
not arguing with, you know, Olympian, former UFC champion of two divisions, Daniel Cormier, but for all my years of, or at least I guess recent understanding since they modified the rules, you have to establish control. There was no establishing of control. So,
yeah. So up until this point, I still gave the third to Usman, but this was certainly the closest. And then in the fourth, I thought this was certainly Covington's round. He was just landing the better strikes. He was kind of drawing Usman into just letting his hands go and was creating openings for himself, and ended the round big as well with several left hands. So, you know, you had the commentary all over the place on what the scoring could be. It's 9 times out of 10, it's going to be, well, it could be even going into this last round. I did not think it was even going into the final round, but maybe some thought it was. And the crowd is like chanting for Covington at this point. Usman just stuns him with a jab, but then Colby would use like this looping left uppercut combo, and the uppercut was his best weapon of this fight, and primarily the last three rounds, which is when he was able to use it the most. There was an eye poke to Covington right near the end, and there's this moment where Dan Mergliotta, the camera's on him, so it's picking up everything he's speaking about to Covington, and he said, "You've got 40 seconds left, so I just don't want you to make some mistake. And he goes to say, "Just don't say, oh, I shouldn't tell you what not to say." And obviously what he was going to tell Covington was, "Don't tell the doctor you can't see, because then they'll wave off the fight." That's like the universal code. But Mergliotta here, just like the camera's right on him, picking up all of this as he's giving advice, or catching himself giving advice to Covington. Anyway, it didn't really matter. There's 40 seconds to go. I thought Usman did enough to win the fifth. But Covington turned this into a much more entertaining fight based on his output in the final three rounds. And Usman wins by unanimous decision, 49-46, 48-47, 48-47. And my card was 49-45. I had Usman winning all but the fourth round, and I did go 10-8 in round two. Did you see it closer?
I did see it closer. I had it 2-2 going into the fifth, but I had the round two being a 10-8. So I was...
I can certainly see three and four for Covington. Three was close. I thought Usman edged them. The fourth, I definitely saw it's Covington's.
Yeah, and then even the fifth was very close.
Yep.
I was really thinking that we could get a draw potential at least on one card. But ultimately, Usman won three rounds. Even if he got because I did give him the third beat just because he had slightly sharper shots in that one. I found. Although, you know, happy to be wrong. You know, I was so wrong. I mean, we talked about this a few times. I thought that there was not going to be wrestling in this fight, at least not from Colby. I didn't think he'd be able to wrestle effectively and it wouldn't help his output. But he did, and it was very useful for him. He was actually the more effective wrestler in this fight, and that was a pretty big surprise.
Yeah, I mean, the big what if you're Colby Covington and his camp is looking at the performance in the first two rounds. It was, you know, you go back and watch that first fight, and it was just from the get-go, nonstop pressure from Covington. And if you mixed in, like, this guy has unbelievable conditioning that we've seen in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Just if you could have pressured him, whether it be mixing things up with the wrestling, you know, you steal that first round, this becomes a much more interesting series of scorecards at the end of it. I just think those two rounds ultimately just, you know, you bank those two rounds for Usman, especially with a 10-8, and that kind of just set the pace. But for the final three rounds, it was a different Covington.
I think a big part of that is because the strategy was to more counter-striking.
Yeah.
And Usman was very good early with the straight shots and being precise. And it took a while for Colby to find a rhythm to catch him with. And then as we saw in 3 and 4, not only did he catch him, but he hurt him. There was more than two or three times where he staggered him. And, you know, as you mentioned, he kind of wobbled him at the end of the fourth round. Right. So, I think it was the timing and just being patient. And, you know, credit to Colby Covington, because he was in some deep trouble in this second round. Like, it was close to he was close to getting put out of there. Came back strong and very tough guy.
Yeah. And afterwards, I mean, they had this moment in the cage where they just both kind of like embraced one another, and it just seemed to be Covington kind of turning off the act for 30 seconds and, you know, both kind of being complimentary to each other on the microphone afterwards. And Covington just saying he's not even at his best yet. He's going to be back in the gym on Monday. And for Kamaru Usman, I mean, he just builds his legacy that much greater. I mean, he is now entering into that territory where people are going to be talking about him in terms of his overall legacy and status in the sport. And this is a division that he has done a pretty remarkable job of shutting down over this past year and a half. When you look at the performances against Gilbert Burns, the two against Masvidal, two against Covington, and you're looking at options of, you know, Leon Edwards is fighting next month against Masvidal, that I think many will favor Edwards in. But the grand question, Phil, that I'm going to throw at you is...
Oh, no. The answer is no.
What is the easier sell for a pay-per-view in 2022? Kamaru Usman versus Leon Edwards or Khamzat in the fast lane, ricocheted right up into a championship fight?
Oh, I thought you were going to say something even more ridiculous. I thought you were going to say, what about if he fights Canelo Alvarez, which is what, of course, you know, was the chatter leading up to this week, which is absurd. No, Khamzat. No, it's Leon Edwards. Like, Khamzat, he's somebody who could be a hot shot.
Leon Edwards is in the position where the UFC will only make that fight if they are literally kicking and screaming to just put together a championship fight and they have no other option. Like, I could see them going with Vicente Luque was actually the backup fighter for this and missed weight for the backup slot, which is that's interesting. First. I don't know if you hold that as like a strike against the guy or not, but nonetheless, he was there in New York to weigh in and he did not make the I think it was like 172.2. But that's what we're looking at welterweight. I think it's like Leon Edwards is probably your front runner unless Masvidal beats him next month. And then I think there's going to be tremendous. I definitely want to see Khamzat in one more, if not two more, significant fights before he is, for his sake, before he is thrown against a guy like Kamaru Usman. We have not seen Khamzat against a high-level wrestler. And to put him in with Kamaru Usman, it's, I don't know. I could certainly, though, see from a marketing standpoint of just Dana White just losing his mind, looking at a 30-second commercial of highlights of this guy to sell a pay-per-view.
Yeah, I think you put him in there with other fights first. I think Islam is much further along into getting a title shot quicker than Khamzat is. Khamzat looks great, but he needs some more fights. And Leon Edwards, I don't think they're that averse to him. I mean, yes, they want big draws in there, and he isn't exactly it. But he was just in a fight with Nate Diaz. It was a high-profile fight. He won. And this fight with Masvidal is
not
a very...
Not in the UFC's record books. Nate finished him in the third round.
And look, the Masvidal fight is a high-profile fight, right? It's got the whole three-piece and soda. So he is being featured there. It's not like the UFC isn't giving him a chance. And they want to go back to England. You know that they want to do that. So... It could make sense. I think he will get the title shot if he gets the W. And then, you know, the rest of the division, they can sort it out. Khamzat can beat a bunch of guys. Wonderboy. Khamzat versus Wonderboy. I like that one.
That's a good fight. I like that fight for Khamzat next, actually. It's going to be interesting because I think that there's a whole lot of steam behind him and a lot of killers in this division that you are... putting him up against.
Well, that's the other, it just feels like there's more meat in this division around the edges that you can give to Khamzat, whereas you know, someone like Islam, he's just further along against those top guys. So Islam's gonna get a title shot next year. Khamzat, it's gonna be the following year.
Can you see a lot of people are going, well, okay, I'll just put this up there. Win or lose next month, could you see Colby Covington and Jorge Masvidal being a fight for 2022?
Oh, it has to be. It has
because
to be.
Because that's what those are the kinds of fights that I see Colby Covington getting now. Fights that you can headline or put second from the top that are not going to be championship fights, but are going to be Covington in featured like attraction style fights, and Masvidal would be the number one pick at this weight class for that kind of a fight.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's just so much built in there. It makes perfect sense. I mean, look, not to rush the gun because I just, you know, not to contradict myself, but maybe not right away, but Khamzat is a good opponent for Colby, right? That makes so much sense. So
that'll answer the wrestling question of how Khamzat does against a high level wrestler for sure.
Yeah.
I guess that's the risk in this matchmaking though, is that, okay, if Colby comes out and just puts this guy on his back for three rounds and takes a decision, what have you done to your division?
Well, look, I mean,
you've killed off a contender and you have a guy that is sort of just frozen out of a title situation. Like, and that's maybe the argument is that, okay, if that's the performance a Khamzat has against a Covington, then he's not really a contender to begin with.
Yeah. Look, you have to build these guys up somehow. You have to put them on TV where they have to win fights. And then sometimes you can maybe skip one or two, but the guys do have to win. And look, Khamzat's been off for so long, and he just got in there and he barely fought. So he's got plenty of Octagon time to show. And even if he loses, it's not the end of the world. It just means he's not this undefeated, unstoppable force.
So Kamaru Usman versus Nate Diaz will be the next championship fight, is what we've concluded here. And is, well, I guess I'll have to figure out his contract situation.
Well, that's actually, because if you're Usman, what is next for you? Because that, other than, you know, because even Edwards, he already beat Edwards. And it, not as a champion, but he already
If I'm Kamaru Usman, I'm looking at, okay, is Nate Diaz an option? You would have to, you know, this guy would have to commit to a new deal. Number two, seriously, if you're being paid based on points, who's the most attractive challenger outside of Nate Diaz in this division? You've beaten Masvidal, and I think that's more of a argument in favor of Khamzat, a relative of an opponent that you, as Kamaru Usman, may see as, I have way too many tools for this guy to deal with, and who is going to engage the most like fan interest for a fight, this or Leon Edwards? Like, if you're looking at it from that standpoint, I could see Usman really campaigning for a give me Khamzat. I would be more than willing to headline a pay-per-view with this guy.
I think you're overselling Khamzat right now and underselling Edwards right now. Maybe in a year the trajectories are a little bit different, and Khamzat,
I think,
if you went to the Discord right now,
put out a poll, okay? Who would you rather see fight for the championship? I think you'd be surprised at how many. Do you know how much buzz there was on Khamzat this past week? Like, I know there was a lot of the people that are. And listen, this is not me saying I would be campaigning for this title fight for Khamzat. I'm just saying that we should be looking at the UFC's history of matchmaking and not throwing out the possibility of them just skyrocketing this guy while he's hot.
He's very hot. He's very popular. And yes, they're going to hotshot him, but I don't see him leapfrogging every single person right now to get a title shot today.
That defeats the purpose. Who's he leapfrogging in the grand scheme of things? He's leapfrogging Leon Edwards.
And he's leapfrogging himself because he's doing himself a disservice. The UFC is doing everyone a disservice by doing it right now versus letting him maul a bunch of numbered guys and it being a really big sell.
But the argument is that if, let's say he got paired with Neil Magny, okay? And
yeah.
Neil Magny just, you know, your top guys have all the answers for this guy. It's, do we just feed this guy to Neil Magny and make nothing versus send him to our champion and at least we get one big pay-per-view out of this guy who is, and we find out if this guy's for real or not.
How big of a pay-per-view is that really? I don't think it's that big. Like, I mean, it's entirely driven by the UFC.
Well, I'd say right now, Usman and Leon Edwards on their own on a pay-per-view is not bigger.
Fair. But I just don't see it as being like a big difference. It's just however the UFC sells it. Yeah, maybe you can sell Khamzat a little bit better, but it's not like he has a built-in audience. So poor Neil Magny. Khamzat versus Neil Magny. Let's do it.
Okay.
They're pulling on that one.
It's made. let's quickly chat about some of these prelims because there were some spectacular fights on the undercard. Headlining the prelims was Alex Pereira, who was former Glory middleweight and light heavyweight champion. Joe Rogan, I wish there was a camera on him because he was in his glory just looking at this man and just he was in awe of this man coming to the UFC in his fifth professional fight, taking on Andreas Mihalidis. And this was not a good first round for Pereira, who was taken down and largely just put largely ineffective in this first round. It was not the most exciting round. The crowd started to boo this, but Mihalidis did enough to win this round convincingly by taking away this guy's weapons. Unfortunately, each round starts on its feet, and that's what the second round began as. And Pereira just drilled this guy with a flying knee. It was so hard that every single person in this arena left on Saturday night completely forgetting the first round and just looking at Alex Pereira as the next killer at 185 pounds. What is going in his favor is the fact that while as a kickboxer, he beat Israel Adesanya not once but twice, including by knockout. What is against him, though, he is 34. And as I mentioned, he is now 4-1 as a professional in MMA since making the switch over. But Phil, I will say, in this middleweight division, going back to our Khamzat debate, this guy will get fast-tracked if he can just put a handful of wins together. But that said, 34, it's like how much time are you going to need to kind of grow to what you're hoping for in MMA? This is a little late to be arriving at the UFC. And I will say it would purely be based on history and trying to find a unique story for Israel Adesanya if this middleweight division is just totally bare of challengers.
I totally agree. Definitely getting hot shot. I mean, they were trying to get him into the UFC for a while. You've heard Dana White talk about him publicly, which is not something he does with the guys who aren't in the UFC too often. And
this was a big spot on the huge prelim in his UFC debut. And
he delivered, right? He delivered in a massive way, right? So
this was a highlight reel finish, 18 seconds of the second round.
I think Joe said something, you know, to the effect of like, he makes people go flying or something at the start of when he was like describing him. And it sounded ridiculous, but he pretty much did make this dude go flying.
He used the word ferocious and monster many, many times in the description of Alex Pereira. But I mean, he's going to be a middleweight that people are going to be engaged in just because of the, like, everyone sees what the potential road is. And he is going to, I think, get a lot more. Again, I just see him totally getting fast tracked because of the age. And if you're talking about Adesanya getting past like Robert Whittaker, this is not a deep list of middleweight contenders that, yeah, this guy could find himself, you know, after how many fights? What is like a crazy number of fights that it would require? That they would be entertaining this. Like, is it as little as three?
Including this one, I would assume, right? So two more.
Yeah, like I personally, just on paper, I think this is like crazy. But I think
okay,
like, there's a story there, and if you don't have anyone, okay, like, lead
so
on
you
that.
Got
lead on that.
There's some fights. There's some people he can put him against. So you had that Luke Rockhold, Sean Strickland fight fall apart. So I think you can put him in there with Strickland. Darren Till. Darren Till's a really good choice, right? I actually think that's probably what they do next.
You're at least going to find out where this guy stands. If you're going from Andreas Mihalidis to Darren Till, you're going to find out real quick where this guy stands at middleweight. And maybe you just have to figure that out now.
Well, I think the idea is that would just essentially be a kickboxing bout, right? Like, if Darren Till's smart, he'll try to take him down.
Like, this is somebody that you go in there with like a heavy or just a semi-competent wrestler. You know, this first round showed like that it's going to be a problem for him.
I agree. I do agree. Is Darren Till a semi-competent wrestler?
He's not going to be, so maybe that is good matchmaking. Bobby Green and Rajan Al Iaquinta. Bobby Green had 10 straight decisions coming into this fight, and Phil, the streak is over. Bobby Green was, you know, sometimes his style, it can be frustrating to watch, and then there's times like this when it just seemed everything was on in this fight. Incredible movement. He is just... Iaquinta is throwing and he's just hitting wind, and he drills Iaquinta with a right hand. Iaquinta goes down and Green follows up with strikes for the finish. 225 of the first round, his first stoppage win since beating James Krause in November of 2013.
The James Krause?
The James Krause.
That's a pretty surprising stat, because Bobby Green is a pretty good fighter, and he's actually looked really good lately, even though he's had some losses. You know, he had that loss to Fizzy, and he looked great in the third round, and he lost to Thiago Moises, and I thought he looked good there. And as you were saying, today everything was just on point. Like, I mean, he must have landed at like 60-70% today. You know, he was talking trash right away, like he always does. His hands were low. Al, I don't think, hit him with anything. Very, very good performance from Bobby Green, who I think is one of the more underrated fighters in the UFC.
And was one of the busiest last year. He fought like four times between June and October last year before taking a bit of a break. But this was a great win for Bobby Green. Did a nice interview with Joe Rogan afterwards. Chris Curtis and Phil Hawes. Hawes was all in control of this fight. Just precise striking. He was landing side kicks to the knee. He was the quicker of the two. And then Chris Curtis said, you know what? Left counter. Boom. He rocked Hawes and followed with another knee up the middle. And Hawes goes down and gets finished by hammer fist. This was like whiplash of just how fast this fight turned in favor of Chris Curtis, who stopped Hawes at 427 by knockout in the opening round.
Yeah, I mean, if you were watching this fight and you were a fan of Phil Hawes, it was going perfectly until it wasn't, and it was over. you know, like
that's the recap.
Yeah, look, Phil Hawes looked incredible in this fight for so much of it, and then he took a shot and couldn't recover. Yeah, no, there's not much more to say other than I do want to see him back in there because it was impressive. And Chris Curtis, you know, he got away with one, if you ask me.
I mean, this guy has been fighting since 2009. He had his time in the PFL, and here he goes into the UFC with his win here over Phil Hawes. Nasruddin Imavov versus Edmund Shahbazyan. Shahbazyan, a highly touted prospect, then got, you know, this is kind of going into our discussion. Like, he was someone that they saw a lot of potential in, and then he got thrown into a big fight with Derek Brunson. And kind of once you're into the deeper end of the pool at middleweight, you're kind of there. And he lost to Brunson. Then he had a decision loss to Jack Hermanson. And during this camp, they were noting that he did get go to AKA for some help on his wrestling. And in the first round here, Shahbazyan is able to escape several guillotine attempts by Imavov. There was also a eye poke here. It was Imavov's round. Into the second, Shahbazyan, who at one point was referred to as Tarverdian by Daniel Cormier, mixing up his Edmonds from Glendale, California.
Yes, the Edmonds all over the place. Our favorite Edmond, I think we must say.
Shahbazyan, he certainly has an immense ability to withstand submissions because he escaped a lot of deep chokes here by Imavov, who just could not believe that he could not submit this guy, who it was very tight that he had this guy with a guillotine. Then he sliced open Shahbazyan with an elbow strike and moves to a crucifix and just starts raining down elbows until Keith Peterson stopped the fight. 4:42 of the second round, Imavov wins by TKO. And it's a third consecutive loss for Shahbazyan, who is only 23 years of age, which is astounding when you look at this guy who has competed in the UFC. This was his seventh fight in the UFC, and he's only 23.
Yeah, very young. Somebody who, you know, as you mentioned, people were very high on, got thrust into, you know, the title picture quickly. Some very brutal losses. This one was particularly bad because there was sort of like this lack of fight IQ in here, where I get it. You went to AKA to improve your wrestling because that was a deficiency, but that doesn't mean you're a wrestler now, because he was the one who was engaging in all the wrestling. He was the one who was trying to take him down all the time. And it was just a big disservice to him. Like, it was, I can understand, you know, when they were striking, Aimovov was getting the better of him, but he was having his moments. And I just think he was just putting himself into an uncomfortable position to engage in all that wrestling. And ultimately, it turned out to be his downfall.
Yeah, I thought there were just some errors in judgment in this fight. I'm not going to write off Edmund Shahbazyan. I think he's too young, and I see a lot of skills in this fighter. Mm-hmm. I think it's just kind of finding a way to put it all together. I think he's just I think he's had a lot of information thrown at him, and he's dealing with like the first series of setbacks in his career. Like, he had not lost any fights up until the Derek Brunson fight, and I think it's just sometimes you can push guys and you're going to see them excel and raise their game. And sometimes you hit a brick wall and you have to figure out a way around that. So, you know, his next fight will be of note, but I'm not ready to just completely write him off yet. I just think he's kind of had this, this reality check at middleweight of where he stands.
Yeah, absolutely. He's very skilled. And as you said, he's 23 years old. There's all the opportunity in the world to grow. And going to AKA and working on your wrestling is the right thing to do. But guess what? It's not going to help you. It's not going to fix all your problems in 6 months or 8 months or however long it was. And it shouldn't be there to turn you into a wrestler. It should be there to help you use your best tools. You should defend takedowns or, you know, get up. And not to say you can't go for takedowns, but it just, if your strength is striking, the tools should accentuate that.
Well said. Yes, I agree. And just a few notes from the Fight Pass prelims. Ian Garry, the former Cage Warriors champion, made his UFC debut. He's 23 years of age, and he finished Jordan Williams. He slipped the left hand, and this right hook just put him out, just landed flush, finishing him with 1 second to go in the first round. But equally as impressive was this guy's interview afterwards. He was outstanding. There's going to be a lot of hype on this guy, and he's only 23 years of age, so there's that magic number again.
Yeah, a lot of hype. He did get hit quite a few times early in this round, but by the time he was able to like create some time for himself, he used his size and his frame really well in the sort of like the grappling exchanges against the cage, and I think that sort of allowed him to reset. And then yeah, just an incredibly timed slip and counter shot speaks in a way that's very engaging, and it's a style that's very exciting. So I definitely think that there's going to be a lot of attention thrust upon him.
In his retirement fight, Jean Volante took on Chris Barnett. This was maybe the most insane fight you're going to see. Chris Barnett, he weighed in at 263.8 pounds. Okay, so remember that number. Landed a spinning wheel kick on John Volante and then finished him. He was just relentless on his back with follow-up strikes and got the finish at 223 of the second round. His celebration was just doing like a giant, like somersault splash onto the canvas. This was outside of Chandler and Gaethje. This is your next must see finish of the night.
Definitely, yes. A highlight reel. You know, you never want to end your career as the victim of a highlight reel knockout. But Chris Barnett made a splash in his second UFC fight, much better than his first one, the short notice scrap against Ben Rothwell.
And then rounding out the show, Dustin Jacoby defeated John Allen by unanimous decision. Melsik Bagdasarian defeated Bruno Souza by unanimous decision. Souza had missed weight by several pounds. He was 148.4 pounds for the featherweight fight. And the opener saw Ode Osborne beat CJ Vergara, who also missed weight for the flyweight fight. Osborne winning on straight scores of 29-28. And that was UFC 268. A pretty solid card, I would say, Phil, including the fight of the past 11 years.
Yes, a really good card. I mean, going into the main card and then that first fight was incredible. And then even the follow-up, the Shane Burgos fight was really
that
good.
That was a really great fight that no one's going to talk about, but they had a very good fight.
And then, you know, the other fights, you know, the Usman-Covington fight was very good. It wasn't as good as the first fight, but it was still, you know, extremely high level. And Covington showed a lot of heart and made it pretty dramatic in there. And, you know, the Zhang Weili-Rose Namajunas fight, while it wasn't the most exciting, it, you know, high level champions, technical, there was more than enough good stuff on this card. And I think anybody who paid for it felt like they got their money's worth.
I think you got your money's worth with the first fight of the pay-per-view. Everything else is bonus. Speaking of bonuses, Phil, I'm going to put you on the hot seat. What tough fight of the night?
What got fight of the night? It was Gaethje Chandler. Come on.
If I'll ever there was a time to break the $50,000 scale, it was for this fight. Gaethje and Chandler got $50,000 bonuses for fight of the night. And I guess they felt generous because they gave four performance of the night bonuses.
Vera Pereira.
Oh, were you guessing or were you reading?
I'm guessing.
Oh, okay, because those were the first two listed here. Vera, Alex Pereira.
And then I'm going to guess.
Throw out your guesses for the other two.
Ian Garry and Chris Barnett.
Chris Barnett, yes. Instead of Ian Garry, it was Bobby
Green.
You
gave it to Kurt. Okay, that's fine. Bobby Green can use the cash.
So there you have it, everybody. UFC 268 in the books. And just looking ahead here before we sign off. So next weekend, Max Holloway is taking on Yair Rodriguez.
That's great. A decent fight night.
That's a really great card. A great main event for a free card. The following weekend, November 20th, has the delayed Misha Tate, Ketlin Vieta fight. December 4th, Jose Aldo versus Rob Font. And then UFC 269, this card, when they showed it on this screen tonight. So, Charles Oliveira and Dustin Poirier is your main event for the lightweight championship. Amanda Nunes defends the bantamweight title against Juliana Pena. Leon Edwards, fighting for everybody's respect, versus Jorge Masvidal. Cody Garbrandt versus Kai Kara-France. Raleigh and Paiva versus Sean O'Malley. Jeff Neal versus Santiago Ponzinibbio. Dominic Cruz. Dude, I'm like seven fights deep here, and I'm getting the Dominic Cruz versus Pedro Munhoz. And then some other ones, including your main event, Phil. Ryan Hall in action against Derek Minner.
Yeah, that's a big step down for Ryan Hall. So that tells you what the UFC is sort of thinking for him. But yeah, a really good pay-per-view. This will be the last one of the year. No New Year's Eve pay-per-view this time.
No, they finish with this one. They have a fight night card December 18th, but then they're not back on pay-per-view till 270 on January 22nd that has Francis Ngannou and Cyril Gane.
Well, that's pretty exciting. I mean, now we can finally settle.
If there was a chance for me to get my most desired headline for one of Eric Marcotte's reports, gone in 60 seconds, it's this fight that Francis Ngannou could produce this.
I think that Mr. Eric believes that Gon is going to be the winner.
I could see Gon winning this fight. That's a very good heavyweight title fight.
Yeah, it's either is Gon going to get touched by Ngannou, or is he going to be able to be technical, stay on the outside, and beat him with technique.
And that has the rematch between Brandon Moreno and Davison Figueiredo as we get ahead of ourselves to January.
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, I'm still a little bit, you know, after the last fight was so dominating, I'm a little bit unsure. But, you know, the first one was really exciting, and it's not like there's a ton of options there in the division. So I'm cool with it.
All right, everybody. Well, there you go. That is our whole report on UFC 268. Phil, I want to thank you very much. It's now the old 3 in the morning, so it's only 2 a.m. now.
I feel like I can go another hour.
I can't. So we're going to sign off and say goodbye to everybody. But thank you so much for tuning in live. We are here after every UFC pay-per-view. So subscribe to the channel, youtube.com/postwrestling. tell Phil what a great job he does for not just the pay-per-views, but every single Fight Night card, manning the Discord. He's a champion here at Post Wrestling.
Well, thank you, John. It was actually very popular in the Discord today. We had a ton of people stopping in for the fights, and really need to give more of a shout out to Mr. Eric Marcotte, because Mr. Eric Marcotte is doing actually much more of the managing of the Discord on the fight nights, always putting up the fight polls. So thank you to Eric and everybody else who comes in and joins and shares your thoughts and musings and lets us know how much you dislike Joe Rogan. You're all welcome. Thank you. Come. And if you do like Joe Rogan, you're welcome too. Come. You're all welcome.
Hey, last thing. Did you get to watch any of the Canelo Caleb Plant fight?
No, because it was on. So
they did not avoid each other this time around.
So I didn't realize last week, but this one was not on DAZN. So when I was co-watching during the show, it was on DAZN, which I had already ordered, so I didn't have to pay any extra. So this was on pay-per-view, and I couldn't watch it live, so I didn't buy it. But I'm going to watch it later. I know what happened. Canelo got the KO in the 11th, and looking forward to seeing how it went down.
All right. Well, thank you as always, Phil. That is it for us. Thank you for listening and watching our UFC 268 post-show.